Samuel chapter 11. 1 Samuel chapter 11. We're going to continue our series in the book of Samuel. While you're turning there, have y'all ever heard of the phrase "Don't make a mountain out of a molehill"? Right? Like, don't make a mountain out of a molehill. In other words, don't blow something up and make it so big that you know it's a problem. But you know, sometimes it's not molehills that attack us, right? It's mountains, and that's what we're going to see right here in 1 Samuel chapter 7 and 1 Samuel 11. I'm sorry. We're gonna meet a mountain. He's an Ammonite mountain. He's a mountain by the name of Nahash. Now, so y'all know, Nahash's name literally means serpent. So trouble shows up at your gate. It's not a molehill that comes to you. It's a mountain that comes to you. And what do you do when trouble shows up at your gate with an army and making demands that even makes the bravest warrior tremble? That's what we're gonna look at. And have you ever noticed when we're talking about trouble that it rarely checks with your schedule? Like, I'd like to show up at your house at Tuesday at 3 p.m. Would that be okay? Does that work? No, trouble comes out to your front door. It's usually uninvited. It's usually demanding attention right now. And that's where we're going to meet trouble. It's in a city by the name of Jabesh-Gilead. And their story, y'all, it speaks straight into our story because every one of us knows what it's like to feel hemmed in, to feel pressured, to feel outnumbered, to feel overwhelmed and on the verge of giving up. Let's jump right in. Then Nabash, the Ammonite, came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. Let's pause here for just a second and break it down. And Nabash, the Ammonite, came up against Jabesh-Gilead and encamped. So Nabash doesn't just attack right away. He sets up shop. He gets comfortable. And I say that because many times that's how Satan works in our lives. He doesn't always knock us out with one blow. Sometimes he camps out. He hangs out. He intimidates, and he slowly makes us feel trapped. And maybe that's going on in your life right now, and the pressure hasn't destroyed you. The fear hasn't crushed you, but it is circling. The temptation hasn't conquered you, but it's camping out nearby. Here's some good news. God knows how to defeat encamped enemies. And the Ammonites here pitched their tent. Now, our God, he is eternally able. He is enduringly and everlastingly there. The Ammonites who pitched their tents, not so much. The Ammonites are never permanent, but God is always on the move. And it says that the Ammonite came and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And this chapter begins with a siege. Nahash, the Ammonite, comes up against Jabesh-Gilead. Now, I want to pause right here because where matters just as much as who. Jabesh-Gilead, so you know, is a city on the west side of the Jordan in the territory of Gilead. And here's the thing. Jabesh-Gilead, they had a checkered past because there was something horrific that happened in Judges chapter 19 and 20 that led to a civil war, and we'll get to that in just a minute. In Judges 19 and 20, it led to a civil war, and Jabesh-Gilead is one of the cities that sided with the other city and had a civil war in the country of Israel. And I say that because it's kind of curious to me that it's these people, the ones that had gone against Israel, that had lost badly, that's going to be crying out for help right now. Hey, you know, you people missed the boat. Hey, you people chose the wrong side. Hey, you people chose to align yourselves with evil people, and now you're asking for help? I don't think so. At least that's the way I think. But here's the thing about God. Our God is in the redemption business. God is weaving redemption, not just through people, but through geography right now. And I find that just wonderful. He doesn't forget places. He doesn't forget people. He doesn't forget the no-shows. And he comes to the rescue. Then Nahash the Ammonite came and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And all the men of Jabesh said unto Nahash, "Make a covenant with us, and we shall serve thee." Church, let's pause right here. Guys, don't you love how the Bible starts with chapters just like this. You know, it came to pass here that Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. That's the Old Testament version of saying, out of nowhere, trouble came. And every one of us has had one of those weeks where Nahash seems to come outside of our house. The paycheck disappears faster than Amazon Prime makes deliveries. The doctor calls with results you weren't expecting. A relationship that seemed solid suddenly feels like quicksand, and before you can blink, you feel like you're Jabesh-Gilead surrounded, intimidated, and you're trying to negotiate with the very enemy who's trying to destroy you. And I want to be real for just a second, because Jabesh-Gilead's opening line, the people of the city, this is their opening line when they're surrounded. Make a covenant with us and we will serve thee. In other words, we surrender, just don't hurt us. Where are we? France? So can we admit that sometimes our first instinct under pressure, though, is surrender? Our first instinct under pressure is just to kind of make an agreement. And when I talk about surrender, I'm talking our first instinct is not the good kind of surrender. It's the bad kind of surrender. It's not the kind of surrender that's like, Lord, I surrender all, or I'm going to give it to you, Lord. That's not the kind of surrender we're under consideration right here. No, this is the kind of survivalist kind of surrender, the kind where you start bargaining with the problem. God, if you get me through this bill, I promise I'm never going to waste money again. And if you heal me this time, Lord, I swear I'm going to eat kale for the rest of my life. And Jesus, if you'll fix this relationship, I'll delete Instagram and I'll never subreddit again. So Jabesh-Gilead is desperate, and Nahash knows it. Nahash the Ammonite shows up at the front porch of Jabesh-Gilead with his army, and he doesn't come asking for sugar. He's demanding surrender, and not just surrender, but he's demanding mutilation, because I want you to read it. It says, and Nahash the Ammonite answered them, verse 2. He's got to be one of the cruelest dudes in history. I don't know if y'all watched The Walking Dead, but picture the character Negan with his bat. This is Negan with his bat, Lucille. And Nahash the Ammonite answered them and said, on this condition will I make a covenant with you, that I may thrust out all your right eyes and lay it for a reproach upon Israel. Wait, what? Back up. Let's hit the rewind. They're begging for mercy. And he says, sure, I'll let you live. I'll make a deal with you, but I'm going to gouge out your right eye for the whole nation to see it. And I don't know about you, but that's not the kind of contract that I'm rushing to sign up for. I mean, can you imagine calling your lawyer, excuse me, but is permanent facial disfigurement, is that enforceable? But here's the deeper truth. Here's the deeper truth, because Satan always negotiates with your destruction in mind. Satan doesn't want your compromise. He wants your vision. And notice, I know Nahash doesn't ask for their left eye. He's targeting the right eye. Why? Because in warfare at that time, the Israelites would carry the swords with their right hand, the spears with their right hand, and they would use their left arm for a shield. So if they've got the shield here, the left eye is blocked by the shield, so they're having to use their right eye in order to see. And if they gouge out the right eye, the nation of Israel is going to be somewhat paralyzed in their ability to fight. And the right eye was critical for aiming an arrow or battling with your sword. To take the right eye was to cripple them purposely. And I want y'all to know, church, that evil still works the same way. Well, evil may not physically gouge out your eyes, but evil is after your vision. Evil wants to steal your sense of direction, your confidence in God's purposes, your ability to clearly see what God has ahead of you. Satan will settle for you being alive but aimless, walking around with blurred vision, unable to fight with focus. So Nahash doesn't just want to blind them. He wants to blind them so that the whole nation will see it. Nahash is wanting to humiliate Jabesh-Gilead here. And he says, and lay it for reproach upon all of Israel. In other words, I want everyone to know exactly that you're weak, that you're defeated, that you're useless. Isn't that how shame works, though? Right? It's never satisfied just to wound you privately. Shame wants to broadcast your failure publicly. Shame doesn't just want to wound you. Shame wants to identify you. It just doesn't want to make you stumble. It wants to define you by your failures. And Satan's ultimate goal is not just your defeat, but your disgrace. But I want you to watch carefully here, because Satan always overplays his hands. And what Nahash intends for shame, God is going to flip into a victory. And that's the theme of redemption running throughout all of Scripture. What was meant for evil, God has turned to good. So let's go on to the next verse. And that verse 3, "And the elders of Jabesh said unto him, Give us 7 days respite, that we may send messengers unto all the coast of Israel. And then if there be no man to save us, we will come out to thee." Now, this is where it gets kind of interesting, because Jabesh-Gilead's leaders are basically saying, hey, give us some time to find some help. Y'all, that's the worst negotiation in history, because they actually might find help, but apparently Nahash is so arrogant that he's like, sure, nobody's going to come to your rescue. Go for it. Nahash is so confident, so arrogant, he agrees, and it's that arrogance that opens up that God uses. And it sets the stage. And I want to pause and apply that, because how many times has God taken a bad thing and used it for good? Satan thought the cross was his victory until resurrection morning. Joseph thought the pit was bad until he was promoted to the palace. Israel looked at the exile to Babylon as a defeat, but God used it to purify their faith. Jabesh-Gilead is out of options, but they're about to discover something crucial. God's already been working on the plan B, and it's been in motion before they even knew it. Now, before we move on to where Saul hears the news and sets up, let me point out something right here before we move on. The people and their negotiations of, oh, let us go and find somebody, they are operating without any faith right now. They're not crying out to God. They're not offering up prayers. They're not quoting Deuteronomy. They're just stalling for time. And still, God uses this weak, half-baked strategy is an opening for his deliverance. And that's good news today, because maybe your prayers haven't been sounding very holy lately. Maybe your prayers are more like, God, I'm done. I can't take anymore. Or maybe you're not even praying at all. You're just making sighs and groans. But here's what the Scripture tells us in the book of Romans. The Spirit intercedes with our groanings that are too deep for words. And sometimes our weak and desperate cries are the exact place that God begins to move. So let's bring this down into our lives. When you're out of options, when the enemy's at the gate, have you ever felt like Jabesh-Gilead? Where something's at your gate, the pressure's mounting, the options look slim, the situation is out of control, and the best plan that you can come up with is really no plan at all? Give us 7 days, and if not, maybe we'll surrender. And maybe for you, it's not Nabash at the gate. Maybe for you, it's anxiety. Maybe for you, it's a financial crisis. Maybe for you, it's the weight of a broken relationship. And it's not Nabash, but it's pride. And you're tempted to just give in and accept the terms that Satan has laid out. You'll never be free. You'll always be broken. And your story's going to end in shame. And here's the thing about God. He's always a deliverer. And the people of Jabesh thought that they had 7 days to find help. What they didn't realize, and that what we're about to see, is God had already been preparing an answer in Saul, and the Spirit was about to move in power. And God didn't negotiate with Nabash. He doesn't bargain with sin. Our God sends and sent a deliverer. So let's transition from verse 1 and 3 that set the scene. This enemy, this Negan, this person with a cruel demand, this situation, a people on the verge of surrender, desperate request for time. But hang on, because the story is about to shift, because when God's Spirit shows up, everything changes. And then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul. Hold on. Remember when I started and said, you know, sometimes places are just as significant as people? Man, we just hit one of the big ones, Gibeah. Because Gibeah was Saul's hometown, but Gibeah, pretty well known for a story that happened in Judges chapter 19 and 20. It was a city in the tribe of Benjamin, and there was this Levite that was walking through, and he had his concubine with him, and he was sitting out there in the city gate, and an old man came by and said, is anybody going to offer you a place? And he goes, nobody's even, you know, so much as offered me a place to stay for the night. The old man says, come on to my house, and I'll feed you. I'll put you up for the night and your concubine. And so he goes. And as night comes, a gang of thugs come out of the city demanding for the young lady and the young man to have their way with them. Just like the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. The old man is so put out that he offers up his virgin daughter. And the gang takes the daughter, takes the concubine, has her way with her, leaves the concubine for dead. The Levite wakes up. She's gone. She's at the doorstep. He takes that concubine and chops her up into 12 pieces and sends it to the 12 tribes and says, you come with me to fight these people or else this is going to happen to you. That's Gibeah. That's where God's going to find help. Nothing is beyond our God. No past that you have, no sin that you've committed, nothing is beyond the redeeming power of God. So this is where we pick up. Then came the messengers to Gibeah of Saul. This place was a place stained by sin. And yet God chooses this place. This broken city, your broken life, as the launch pad for Israel's first king and the place where deliverance is going to come for Jabesh. And that's God's pattern throughout Scripture. He redeems broken places, broken peoples. He writes new stories with tragic and ugly histories. And then the messenger came to Gibeah of Saul, and he told the tidings in the ears of the people. And all the people lifted up their voices and wept. So the messengers arrive in Saul's hometown with bad news, and everyone's weeping, and rightly so, and it's terrifying, and sometimes the only honest response is tears. But why are they crying? Because at this point in Israel's history, they are leaderless in heart. I mean, they have a king. Saul's been anointed, but when they show up, notice what Saul's doing. He's not in the palace. He's not on the throne. He's plowing with some yoke of oxen. That's newly anointed king, and he's still working the family farm. And doesn't that sound familiar to us? Because sometimes we can read the promises of God and live just lackluster lives. We can have the certainty of scriptures on paper, but not live it in practice. And this covenant that's written, this victory that's promised, we could still be paralyzed in our situation. But watch what happens, because in verse 5, Saul walks in and the whole atmosphere is about to shift. It says, and behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field. And I love this verse because Saul was out in the field doing ordinary work, following the herd. He's not on the throne yet, and he's not commanding armies yet. He's just doing an ordinary day's work. And what that verse reminds me, and behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field. What that verse reminds me is that God works in people's lives in ordinary moments. When you're changing the diaper, when you're wiping the tear, when you're holding the hand, when you're sending the card, God works in ordinary moments, and he does something great with them. And here comes Saul. He's fresh from the field after following a herd of oxen. This guy's supposed to be king, and he's doing farm work. And you can almost picture it. I mean, Israel's first monarch, dust on his sandals, sweat on his brow, smelling like his own livestock. This is not royal procession. This is tractor pull. And Saul's been crowned a king, but he hasn't stepped into his kingship. He's anointed, but plowing. And maybe that's a word for somebody here. You can have a calling on your life and not yet be working in your calling. And y'all do. And behold, Saul came after the herd out of the field, and Saul said, "What aileth the people that they weep?" And they told him of the tidings of the men in Jabesh. So Saul hears their cries, and he wants to know why. And that's leadership 101. You know, you care enough to ask why people are hurting. Verse 6. And the Spirit of God came upon Saul. And this is the turning point, where Saul hears about the injustice and something happens. The Spirit of God comes upon him. And I want you to watch this. He doesn't cry harder. He doesn't panic. He doesn't throw up his hands. He gets angry. And I love that, because it's okay to get angry as long as it's a holy angry. There's a difference between human anger and a holy anger. Human anger explodes and destroys, and holy anger shifts and stirs the courage to protect, to fight for the vulnerable, to confront evil. And some of y'all have been told in your life that you have an anger problem. And maybe it's true, but maybe, God just gave you some fire, not to destroy, but to defend. And what's breaking your heart and spurring that anger might be the very thing that God is calling you to fight. And I had an interaction with someone the other day, and they're like, "You seem angry." And I'm like, "No, I'm not angry. I'm passionate." Because since I was a young kid, I was always passionate about things being fair. Verse 7, and it says, "And Saul took a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hand of the messenger." So I want y'all to dig it. So he took some oxen, he cut it up, and he sends it to all. This is the first group text. But instead of opening emojis on their cell phone, they're opening packages and having ox parts. You dig what I'm saying? Whoa, rut-row. And he essentially says in the group text, "Hey, look, y'all are going to plant a flag. You're going to pick a team. You're going to choose. And if you don't fight with me, then this is going to happen to your own oxen right here." That's the group text that gets sent out. That's a little. It's like the original Godfather, except instead of waking up with a horse head, you open a package with an ox head. It sounds extreme, but it works. "And the fear of the Lord fell on the people, and they came out with one consent." So Saul was unifying the nation, and God was using this dramatic moment to rally his people. But here's the deeper truth from this. God still uses unconventional methods to get our attention. Sometimes it's a sermon. Sometimes it's a crisis. Sometimes it's a broken season in our life. But when the fear of the Lord grips your heart, you realize that you can't sit this one out. "And he took a yoke of oxen and hewed them in pieces and sent them throughout all the coast of Israel by the hands of the messengers," group text, "whosoever cometh not forth after Saul and after Samuel, so it shall be done unto his oxen. And the fear of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out with one consent." And people see the seriousness. They realize this isn't optional. And it said the fear of the Lord fell upon the people. Notice it didn't say the fear of Saul. This guy's nuts. It says the fear of the Lord. The people rally not because Saul is intimidating, but because God is at work. And 330,000 people show up. That's not just a response. That's a revival. And I want you to notice the geographic significance here, because it says, And Saul sends the message throughout the coast of Israel, and that means from Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, every tribe is summoned. God is gathering a fragmented nation together. And verse 7 says, the fear of the Lord fell upon the people, and they came out with one consent. This isn't just Saul, this is God's Spirit uniting. Because it is a king that can call, but it's a God that conquers hearts. And so it says, verse 8, and when he had numbered them in Bezek, the children of Israel were 300,000, and the men of Judah 30,000. And they said unto the messengers that came, thus shall ye say unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by that time, the sun be hot, ye shall have help. And the messengers came and showed it to the men of Jabesh, and they were glad. Now, I want you to pause here, that little phrase, by the time the sun is hot. That is so specific. They could have just said, hey man, help's on the way, hang in there, it won't be long. But God gives them a promise with a time stamp, and that's encouragement, because God knows not just what he's going to do, God knows when he's going to do it. I mean, I panic, we panic, we don't know the timing. We want the Google calendar that says deliverance scheduled for 11:45. Please allow 2 to 3 business days for processing. But God says, no, no, no. I got the clock in my hand. And I want you to notice what happens. It says, and they were glad. Now dig it. The circumstances hadn't changed yet. All they had was news. Good news. Gospel news. Deliverance is coming. Take courage. And so they took heart. They got hope. And it says, therefore the men of Jabesh said, tomorrow we will come out to you. They're talking to Nahash, and they say, hey, look, Nahash, tomorrow we will come out unto you, and you shall do with us all that seemeth good to you. And that kind of makes me laugh internally. The men of Jabesh tells Nahash, don't worry, tomorrow we're going to come out and you can do whatever seems good to you. Sounds like a little bit like surrender, but it's not. Sounds a little bit like they're giving up, but they're not, because they know help is on the way, but they don't let the enemy in on the secret. And that's kind of a powerful principle here. You don't always have to let people know what God is doing in your life. They kept it to themselves, and sure enough, the help comes. And maybe you're in that in-between moment right now, and the enemy thinks that you've surrendered, but you're just kind of waiting on God for deliverance. Let's pick up with verses 11 through 13. And it was so on the morrow that Saul put the people in three companies. And they came up in the midst of the host in the morning watch, which was typically, y'all, between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. So this is a surprise attack. And they slew the Ammonites until the heat of the day. Just like the promise. And it came to pass that they which remained were scattered, so that two of them were not left together. And the people said unto Samuel, who is he that said, because y'all remember this was said in the last chapter, shall Samuel reign over us? Bring us that man that we may put them to death. And Saul said, there shall not be a man put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. So let's marinate in what we just read, because the morning comes. Saul divides his armies into three groups, a classic military tactic. They attack at dawn, they surprise Nahash and the forces, and by noon it's over. And the people are so scattered that you don't even have two of them running together. They're all, every man for himself, running away. And after the victory, the people remember the doubters of Saul, that he shouldn't be king, and they're ready to execute. And Saul says, show some restraint. There shall not be a man put to death this day, for today the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. So Saul refuses to use his victory as a vendetta. He knows that glory belongs to the Lord. And what a lesson for me. When God gives victory, don't waste it on petty payback. Celebrate the salvation. But this verse also shows us that victory often comes after a long fight. Because I want you to notice that it said, until the heat of the day. They had to fight for hours. Deliverance was promised, but they needed some endurance right there, right there. So if your fight is longer than you thought, don't lose heart. God's promise is true, and sometimes the fight might go on to noon, but the outcome is secure. And if Saul had killed his doubters, the story would have shifted from God's salvation to human politics. So instead, Saul wisely declares, let's not pollute this day. Let's not pollute this victory. Let's set it aside and remember who gave it. Now let's read the last two verses. Then said Samuel to the people, come and let us go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. And all the people went to Gilgal, and they made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal, and they were sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And there Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly. So Samuel, the prophet, calls the people to Gilgal to renew the kingdom. So y'all know that when Israel went into the promised land, you know, they hung out in the desert for 4 years because of their disobedience, and they get into the promised land. Gilgal is the first place where they celebrated the Passover. And Samuel said, let's go back there. Let's renew our hearts. And what started in 1 Samuel chapter 11 with tears and threats and shadow of humiliations, it ends right here with rejoicing and worship and renewal. And Nahash wanted to take away their right eyes. He wanted Israel's victory to end in shame, but God had a different ending in mind altogether. And he raised up a king, and he filled them with the Spirit, and he unified his people, and he brought them victory. And Saul, to his credit, says, the Lord hath wrought salvation in Israel. And that's the story of this chapter. But it's also the story of the gospel. Because you and I stood under the threat of an enemy who didn't just want to inconvenience us. He wanted to blind us, to humiliate us, to destroy us. And sin and shame had us surrounded. And like the men of Jabesh, we had no power to save ourselves. We wept, we fear, we looked for compromise. And into this hopelessness, into our story came another king, not Saul, but Jesus. Not a reluctant king from a farm field, but the Son of God from heaven's throne. And he didn't just rally an army, he stepped into the battle himself. And at the cross, Jesus took the full weight of the enemy's threat. He faced the humiliation, not with compromise, but with courage. And then 3 days later, the grave was empty and the enemies were scattered and salvation had been won. That's grace. We didn't earn it. We didn't fight for it. We just received it. And like the people of Jabesh, we wake up some mornings with one hope where there had once been despair. And Psalm 30, verse 5 says it perfectly. Weeping may endure for night, but joy cometh in the morning. And here's the invitation. Just like Israel gathered at Gilgal to renew the kingdom, you and I are called to gather at the feet of Jesus and renew ourselves in Him. And maybe you've doubted Him. And maybe you've compromised. And maybe you've been staring at the enemy's threats so long that you have forgotten God's promise. Let this be your Gilgal moment. Come and renew your kingdom. Come and lay down your life before the true King. Come and enjoy the peace offering that isn't an animal on an altar, but the Lamb of God on a cross. Because the same God who turned humiliation into celebration in Jabesh is the same God who turned sinners into saints, who turned shame into testimony, who turns defeat into everlasting joy. So don't walk away with just a history lesson today. Walk away with hope. Walk away knowing that the threats, no matter the tears, no matter the Bibles, the invitation still stands. Come unto me, all you are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That's grace. That's gospel. That's the invitation.